Hello and welcome back to episode 5 of the Post Production Club podcast. We have a very exciting episode today. My name is Luke Fritz.
And I'm Gavin Buckland. Today we have Craig Scorgi. He's a film editor and visual effects artist. He worked as a visual effects editor on the film Women Talking, which won an Oscar in 2022. And he's also a VFX editor on Apple TV's The Morning Show. Also working on as an editor, VFX editor on HBO's Big Little Lies and Amazon's The Expanse. So if you're wondering what a VFX editor is and how that differs, we talk about that. We talk to him all about the new film that is very timely, set in Pakistan, called In Flames. It's a horror thriller that centers on a young woman who's become haunted by a vision of the past after the death of the family's patriarch leaves her and her mother in a vulnerable and social position in Pakistan's highly patriarchal society. It had its world premiere at Cannes Film Festival in the director's Fortnite section, which if you're wondering what the heck that is, no need to wait a fortnight to find out. We cover all that and more. Craig, welcome to the Post Production Club podcast. Man, that is a long title. I am going to just shorten it. I'm going to say welcome to the club. All right, you're in the club now.
Nice. I've always wanted to be in the club. Now I'm here.
Welcome. Where does this podcast find you?
I'm in Toronto, Ontario, Canada right now, which I hear is the sister city of Chicago. So I guess we're neighbors.
Yes, absolutely. I've never been there to my sister town, but how is it up there?
It's fine. Yeah, it's getting a little pricey up here, the cost of living. I'm in a borough of Toronto called East York. Very quiet, very nice. Moved out here last year, and it's been great. I was living downtown for a while, and I think I was losing my mind a little bit. So happy to be here.
And you just had a baby.
I did. Yeah, March 28th. Had my first baby. His name is Bram. He's awesome.
That's an awesome name. How are you doing? How's your wife doing?
We're doing great. We've got like the shift system figured out. We're both at least getting 6 hours of sleep, which a lot of our friends who have babies are like up every 2 to 3 hours. So we're pretty lucky. We're able to function and not completely lose our minds. And he's like an easygoing baby. So lucky on that front too.
That is incredible. I'm so glad to hear it. How are you managing being like a creative and being working on projects while having the baby?
Yeah, so I think I was pretty lucky in that I was able to find work up until the point where the baby was born. And I let everyone know. I was like, this baby could come at any second, so we should be prepared. I was on a documentary. They ended up choosing to transition to another editor, which I think was great. Like, and it was a smooth transition, and they're continuing to work on where I left it. And yeah, there's no, parental leave in the industry, at least here. So I'm just taking time off, just choosing not to take work for a period of time. And I'm looking, my agent is looking for stuff for me to start like maybe July or end of June. So, and this is the first time looking for work that I'm not totally anxious about like never working again. Everyone feels that. But, I'm like, if it doesn't work out, I have extra months to hang out with this baby. So that's pretty cool. And I also have a great excuse to not be working. If people are like, what happened to him? He hasn't done anything recently. This is my excuse. So it's a great situation for me right now if I'm not working. Yeah.
Well, I want to dive right into it. You've worked as a VFX editor and an editor. I want to kind of hear the difference in what people think is normally like an editor. How does being a VFX editor differ from how people normally think of as classic editorial?
Yeah, so there's actually two types of VFX editors, and I've done both, so I can speak on both of them. Probably the most known VFX editor is on the production side. So VFX editor is essentially a assistant editor who focuses on visual effects. So when you're a first assistant editor on a film or a TV show, often you're, and if you don't have a visual effects editor, you're still doing all the same work that a visual effects editor would do. You're doing temp visual effects that they can use in the cut, you know, if they have a test screening coming up or if they need to show the director an idea of like a solution that they might use VFX for. We do temp effects a lot in editorial, just, you know, especially on projects where money is tight, but even just to throw ideas at the wall and see like, could this even fix the scene before we pitch it to the VFX department? So there's always temp VFX that we're playing around with. And then also there's the whole side of logging and tracking visual effects. And on a show where the amount of visual effects is so large, it's too much work for the assistant editor. So they need to hire someone specifically for that. So that's what the visual effects editor does. So most recently, my last visual effects editor on production job was on the movie Women Talking, which won an Oscar for adapted screenplay. And on that project, my role, and I had a great relationship with the editor. So they're actually consulting me of like when they're cutting a scene, instead of just cutting a scene and handing it to me, being like, what do you think? Does this work from a visual effects standpoint? Can we pull this off? And I would have some input in how, shots were cut together from a visual effects perspective. I was doing temp effects. And I think on that film, we had about 800 shots we were tracking. And usually on like a studio film like that, what happens is, you know, that while they're working on the director's cut, we turn over all of the shots to visual effects. So turnovers, you send all the elements that they need, you send them all the information, you give the shot a number, how many frames, what frames, how many handles, and the visual effects people start working on it. But this whole time while they're working on it, the cut is changing and evolving. So they need someone like me to update them. So every time there was a new cut, I'd have to send a report like, this shot with this number is, you know, 8 frames longer on the tail and 4 frames shorter on the head. And like, do we need to send you a new pull? Like, do we need to send you the elements all over again? So it's like a constant conversation with visual effects of what they need and what we're doing to change the cut. And if there's any new shots that we haven't discussed, and if there's any shots that we've omitted, like if the editor just deletes a shot in their edit, we need to let them know to like stop working on it, because that's just a waste of time working on visual. And that can easily happen if you're not tracking it properly. And at that level, you use outside of the editing software in Excel, you start using like FileMaker Pro and like a database software like that to calculate these changes so that you can be more accurate and not easily make mistakes that would waste a lot of money. So it's really important to know what you're doing when you're on that level. And it took me a while to become so familiar with visual effects that I could do that. And then the second type of visual effects editor is on the vendor side. So editorial and you know, we're always working with independent vendor that makes visual effects. In the case of Women Talking, it was Ghost VFX, which is sort of a sub company of Streamland. So usually on the vendor side, they also have a visual effects editor, and their job is, you know, I think now everything is virtual, but when I was doing it, I did it on the morning show, Apple TV, and I was working at a visual effects house, and there everyone was working in person, and there's like a floor, they called it the floor of visual effects artists all churning away these shots, and there's thousands of shots in this show. And every day, you know, at like noon or 1 p.m., we would schedule a VFX review. And so I would go into the database and look up all the renders that were available at that particular time. I also have a copy of the show. I cut in those shots and I sit down with the visual effects supervisor and we talk about it and we discuss like changes that the team needs to make because, you know, person A is working on this shot, person B is working on the next shot, and they're in a sequence and they don't look right. So they need to look like the same world, the same environment. So we need to come up with a set of notes to give back to the team, and that sometimes they come in and discuss it with us. And then we're all preparing for this big end of the week review with the client, which is production, where I was, that was my job on Women Talking, where I would be conducting a review with the VFX team, and I would be giving them notes on what they've done, and, you know, in conversation with the director and the editor and everything. So there's two different types of those, and they're, in some ways, they're very similar, but also, you know, I think both pieces are I'm really, really fortunate I got to do both jobs, because it taught me a lot about what it's like on the other side, like a peek behind the curtain of what, like a big major visual effects company, what they go through on a show like that, and how to talk to them and speak their language.
Yeah, when you think of a show like The Morning Show or even Women Talking, they're not super heavy VFX explosions and CGI characters doing crazy things. And I feel like that's when people really start to rag on VFX. It's really easy to rag on bad CGI with big things like that. But good VFX is invisible VFX. So talk to me about some shots that you guys worked on for any of those pieces.
And that's the funniest thing. Like, some of the most visual effects heavy, like, and I've worked on sci-fi and stuff, but like some of the most visual effects heavy shows I worked on, you would never know. Big Little Lies was one too that had like a huge amount of visual effects. A lot of it is create, like The Morning Show. It was like they only had the budget to shoot it in, you know, to get all the stars on set, they had to shoot it in LA and with their timing and everything. But the story takes place in New York. So it's constant, like changing all the backgrounds. These very dynamic shots, like tracking down a street, walking, and you have to change all the buildings. You have to change what the buses look like. So much goes into it. And like, you know, they're shooting in the studio because it's easy to set that up. And everything is green screen. Like most interiors on like a studio production or car shots or anything are all like visual effects usually. In the case of Women Talking, the whole film takes place in a barn mostly. We get out of it once in a while, but it's in this hayloft at the top of the barn. And that was a studio. We couldn't shoot in an old barn, it wouldn't be safe. So we had to build a barn, we had to shoot in it, and everything behind there is blue screen. So, you know, they had a very specific aesthetic for the set, where there's like little cracks between the wood slats, and there's holes in the wood where the knots are, and there's all these windows that they open up and look out on the community. All of that was visual effects. And sometimes, like, I mean, my experience, I'm a comp artist, so that's my specialty, and maybe it's no coincidence that I was able to do well in those jobs and get those jobs, because I know comping a little bit more than other things. But I find, like, you know, green screen and rotoing and stuff, like, it's a lot of people think it's really easy, like you drag this filter, it just filters out all the, oh shit, my, sorry. My screen popped up. A lot of people think there's just like this effect, this green screen effect, and you just like drag it on, it takes out all the green. But it's, you know, like Women Talking, we're working with these vintage lenses that bend light in really weird ways. And like, you know, like a source of light, like a sunset or something behind a character, it halos and flares the lens and warps the light in very strange ways. And, you know, that sounds very technical, but you look at the shot and everyone's just saying like, oh, it doesn't look real, but people don't know how to articulate beyond that. so it's like I have to come up with like solutions or ideas of like, maybe it's this, maybe it's, you know, maybe it's the motion tracking or the depth of the background or the parallaxing, or maybe it's haloing of light. You know, there's so many things. And it, you know, it's like we're racking our brain sometimes looking at these shots, being like, it just feels fake, but like, why? It's like, it's so hard to do.
What are the best tips and questions that you've come up with that help people and directors and producers give more helpful feedback?
I think it's important to have someone on the team who can translate. I know from being a visual effects artist that, like, you know, usually you're presenting a shot because, unless you're under crazy time restrictions, you're presenting something because you can get behind it. Like, you think it looks good. So when people say, well, it doesn't look real, it's hard to. And this is the same for feedback and editorial too. Like, you know, like those types of non-specific, non-constructive notes are really difficult to receive, but often they come from a place of like just not understanding the craft. So the more that people can speak the language of the people that they're talking to, I think like the more easy. And I like to present my notes as questions because like I'm not in their projects. I don't know how they've built out the shot. I'm just reacting to the shot. So, you know, I'm asking, you know, maybe could it be something in the motion tracking? Could it be something in the blending? Is it an edge thing? Because sometimes, you know, if an edge looks a little too weird, like if a character has like a black or a white edge, sometimes it's nothing to do with visual effects. Sometimes it's like the colorist and something that's happening there because they receive a matte from visual effects and they push the color, but like it introduces all these artifacts. So if you're giving notes on those artifacts to the visual effects company, it's like, well, maybe it's happening in color. And maybe that means you need to match the look and color a little bit closer so that they're not pushing it as far. So there's so many things that can go wrong, and it's important to be open-minded and ask questions and just respond to your feelings of like, it feels like these things aren't, like they don't feel realistic, and you know, I have some ideas, but I'm curious what you think, kind of thing. And usually if you approach it that way, it's, you know, just with respect and with treating them like the expert and you're not the expert. I think it's like good to, usually you'll, you know, reach a solution together, and that's like any collaborative environment. You know, not being an expert and just asking questions and being open-minded and only speaking about your feelings and your like gut reactions, but not like, you know, making judgments about the quality of their work or anything like that.
Yeah, we talked to Matt Platts-Mills, who did the Gentleman, he edited all that, and we talked about like edits a lot there too, and like review, and his big thing was kind of like, what's the note within the note? It was like his big,
that's something I say too, and, like, that must be a thing.
Yeah, so how do you like decipher that? So it's cool to hear that, because that's like a thing in editorial, right? Like a story decision, mm-hmm. of like, I don't really like that decision or that cut. But it's also a thing in visual effects of like, what part of this effect isn't working? Because maybe the whole thing, like overall, is good, but there's just like a small bit. So you don't have to like,
yeah,
go back to the drawing board if it's just like a small thing.
I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with Walter Murch, editor, wrote book Blink of an Eye. And in that book, he talked about that same thing where he's like, you know, test screening. He talks about test screenings. And he's like, you know, sometimes people's prescriptive feedback in a test screening is like going to the doctor, your arm is hurting, and saying to the doctor, like, you need to amputate my arm. You know, it's the doctor's job to, you tell them your symptoms, you tell them what you're feeling, and maybe if you have a suspicion. But it's the doctor's job to discern what to do with it. So any type of creative feedback is exactly like that. You know, if a test screening, someone's like, you need to cut this scene. It's like, what, you know, like, what are all the steps that led you to that? Let's explore that. And when you're lacking that, you have to guess and try, it makes it a lot harder, but it's always helpful to ask questions and like, investigate that.
Having worked in visual effects and editorial, more narrative based editorial, which do you like more?
I'm definitely more, I think editing has always been second, or sorry, visual effects has always been secondary to editing for me. It's a skill. I'm sorry. You know, I never set out to be a visual effects artist. It kind of happened by accident, and I was, while I was pursuing editing, I was, you know, I was an assistant editor at the time of this documentary, and they'd come to me and they'd say, you know, like, we need this sort of motion graphics of this thing. Can you do it? And I wanted the job. So I said yes. And then I just figured it out on the job, like After Effects or whatever, doing it. And then eventually it worked out and I had a kind of knack for it. So when I was an assistant editor, that was kind of the edge I had over other assistants, was like, you know, I'd say I'm a visual effects artist. I can do these things. And sometimes what I did ended up in the final, especially in Canada, where a lot of things are government subsidized, it's like lower budget indie stuff. Sometimes often on indie films that I edit, it's like, there's a lot of really straightforward shots that I could do in like an hour or two. So I do those for temp in the edit anyways. So it's not really that difficult for me to like relink what I did with the final online media. So I'll get a visual effects credit on that. But usually it's for me, it's a tool to make me a stronger editor. And it's something, you know, I think it's important for me to learn more about it and develop that skill, because when I'm editing, my knowledge of visual effects helps me to be an editor, because you're always problem solving a scene. And often, you know, if you're only looking at the tools in your edit software, it feels like, you know, sometimes there's nothing we can do. This is just something that has to live in this film. But the more you know about visual effects and other things, like, or even sound, the more you can realize like, oh, we can totally, like, there's multiple options available to us that we didn't even realize. And I think I've been in so many of those situations where I found like a crucial fix to scene or the film, that kind of fixed a major story issue, and it was like arrived at in sound or visual effects, sort of outside of my department. So anything I can do to like understand those departments more, helps me be a better editor. And, it's a shiny thing that I can market myself, because I have credits as a visual effects artist. But I'm not, I haven't, you know, sometimes when the work is dried up in editing, I'm able to get some jobs doing comps and stuff on indie features. But it's always in service either to make money when I can't make money, or it's helping my editing.
Share a bit about your journey into the world of filmmaking. How did you start your career, and what led to your work on In Flames?
Yeah, I was, I didn't go to like a proper film school. I went to media school at Toronto Metropolitan University. And it was kind of like a catch-all program we learned. And this is where I first learned visual effects, because they taught After Effects and everything. It was kind of a generalist program and approach. And I had a hunch that like editing was one of the things. I was also really interested in cinematography, directing too. And so I just, you know, when I graduated, I tried all the things. I worked on set. I tried directing little shorts myself. And just through the process of elimination, I realized editing was what I enjoyed. I think just like my brain happens to work a little bit better and arrive creatively at something when I'm a collaborator and I'm not like the main leader of a project. And I didn't like being on set. So I was like, okay, that's what I do. The way to editing, there's multiple ways you can just start editing, and that's really hard to get into editing. I wanted to learn from editors. I wanted to have mentors and learn the craft while working as an assistant editor. And that's usually what I recommend people to do, because it's like it's really good work, it's reliable work. But there's so much you can learn from, you know, the safe space of assistant editing. You're able to sit, you know, I was able to work on studio films that as an editor might take a lifetime even to get to that level to edit, but like I'm able to sit in those rooms, make connections in those rooms, and I'm also able to like see what it takes to make a film or TV show like that. And I can take that knowledge to my indie projects, right? Like I can treat them all the same with the same level of like attention to detail and stuff like that. So I was assistant editor for like 13 years. And I decided you kind of, in Canada, you kind of have, I've heard in the States, you can quietly edit in the background while you're assisting because it's a bigger industry. In Canada, it's a little bit small. So it's, and it's all about personal branding. And I knew that the, you know, the best advice in Canada is like, pick a time when you're an editor and just like stop taking assistant work and tell everyone I'm an editor now. I'm not an assistant. So I had to strategically pick a time and I had to push it back a little bit. But I took the I went to the Canadian Film Center, which is kind of like the there's an American version, AFI, I think. Is that right? It's kind of like that. It's like a residency where you meet other directors and stuff. So I took that, and that was my launching pad into editing. And the director, Zarar Khan of In Flames, was a director at that residency. So we already, and he only edited his shorts before me. He was looking for an editor for his feature, and we happened to really click in that program. So In Flames was my first feature film as an editor, which is pretty incredible that I got that lucky. And I knew what kind of films I like and what kind of films I wanted to make. And as soon as I entered that program, I looked at everyone's work and at Zarar's work. I was like, this is, I was so determined to work with this guy because I was like, he makes exactly the kind of films that I want to work on. And, you know, we really clicked and we figured out a process to work together. And then I guess the rest, you know, I'm still, I'd say I'm like in the early stages of my editing career. I've done three features. I've done two documentaries. Trying to push myself into television a little bit too. But I have an agent, which is helping. But yeah, it's kind of still figuring it out. But
yeah, to have your first feature dominate it, In Flames dominated at so many festivals. It premiered at Cannes Directors Fortnight, which. What is that? Can you speak to what that part of Cannes is?
Yeah, so there's sort of the at Cannes, there's several festivals. There's, and I might not remember all their names correctly. there's Festival de Cannes, which is the main one. And there's sort of sort of smaller programs of that, like Uncertain Regard, an official competition. And then there's Critics Week is one, and then there's Directors Fortnight, and those are kind of the three main ones. They're technically separate organizations. They're all happening at the same time, in sort of the same strip. And Directors Fortnight is kind of more focused on genre, and sort of more, I'd say, like, new wavy type stuff, like stuff that, you know, like official selection, often it's like there's first features that get into that, but you know, Directors Fortnight is more of like the kind of emerging filmmaker genre film kind of festival. Critics Week is, I think, I could be wrong, I think it's like more drama focused. So, you know, we were there during all those festivals, you know, partying on the same beach. It was great. And it's where I think Pulp Fiction played at Directors Fortnight. There's a lot of like incredible movies that like screen there. So it was quite an honor to be part of that tradition. And, you know, hopefully Zarar being in that will only set him up to potentially do, you know, official competition or something like that in the future, which would be awesome.
And then it ended up being Pakistan's entry to the Oscars. What was it like when you found out that it was possibly going to be nominated in the Academy Awards?
I mean, I feel like you have to understand, like, this whole time we didn't expect any of these things. So, like, it was like each thing was building off one another. And so I was just kind of gobsmacked at that whole thing. Never imagined it would be possible. It's my first feature. And also, like, we're very, very low budget, from a program in Canada called Talent to Watch, which is like a program at Telethon, which is like the government body that funds films. Talent to Watch is like the smallest budget and level, and up until our film, like, none of the films from that program had kind of done these things. So it was, you know, like, there was no examples in the past of, like, you know, films that had done this before from that, from these type of origins. Like, so even for a Canadian film to do all those things is pretty rare. So yeah, anything was just a gift. And you know, I'm the type of person, I approach a situation with the worst possible expectations. I always assume that things aren't going to go well, which sounds weird, but I feel very prepared and capable and calm when things don't work out. And then I figure if things do well, then that's great. You know, I'm able to deal with that news easily. But I never expect things to go as far as In Flames did. And that was incredible. Yeah.
So I want to hear about the editing process of the film. Is there any like story that comes to mind about that was really challenging, a really challenging scene or a moment in the editing process?
Overall, from a general perspective, it was interesting in how we approached the editing of that film, because Zarar is an editor, and that's like, I think in order for him to properly express his intentions, you know, he could sit over my shoulder and tell me like, do this and then do that. But I think we decided that he needed to edit the first pass of the film. So he shoots very intentionally. He's like, this shot, kind of like the South Korean style of filmmaking, where they're like, this shot is intended for this line of dialogue on this character, and they just shoot exactly what they think they need, and they storyboard it so specifically and shoot with intention so that they're using like the best out of their time. So he approached it that way. There were a few options, but it was very intentional. So, and even to the frame of like what he wants to cut to the next shot. So he needed, I think we agreed that he needed the opportunity to like express all of those intentions and see it the way that he imagined it on set. And then he sent it to me, and then he was like, go crazy, do anything you want to do. Traditional editor's first cut is like, I'm going to keep it safe. You know, maybe you're not ready to see some of my ideas, but he was like, I want to see all your craziest ideas on this first draft. So, and I did some things that even I wasn't sure about, but I was like, let's just try it. Let's move this scene here, see what it does. And then, so it was like starting at the director's cut and then the editor's cut. Usually it's the opposite. And then we worked on the fine cut, which was like kind of a marriage of our two versions, specifically of a scene. I think there's a scene at the end, without spoiling, was like a pretty interesting scene to edit. In a way that I haven't seen in other films, where it's like two characters, their timelines are merging together. They're two characters having flashbacks that are merging with the present timeline. And it's like all reaching a certain climax in a situation. And it was scripted a completely different way that we knew immediately in the first cut that like, it just wasn't working that way. So that was a really interesting scene to edit, because we almost had to invent a language of like cutting between those timelines and those flashbacks in a way that felt natural and people could understand it visually, but also had the dramatic tension of like, you know, what's going to happen, keeping it current and present. Because when you cut to, we didn't even realize like when you see one flashback of an event and you see another flashback event, it's like less exciting to see the same thing twice from a different perspective. So like keeping it all feeling present was such a challenge. And I'm really proud of that scene, cause I think it's really unique, to that film. Yeah.
That's cool. Talk to me about how the source material, it being set in Pakistan, is incredibly timely with current events. I'm curious how that impacted you guys in the creative process and even in the reception of it.
I mean, it was interesting. Like, and unfortunately, a lot of these issues are ever present And like, you know, I forget what was happening at the time when we were editing this, but like, you know, it's a little too unfortunate that this film could have come out in many different years and it would have felt current and of the moment. But I think that was even more so, like, once we saw what was happening in Gaza and everything, when the film started going to the various festivals and that became part of the conversation during Q&As. I think it's just in the zeitgeist, and just a sign that the story is like universal, and I think these issues of oppression and you know, misogyny specific to In Flames are kind of like relatable, unfortunately, in many parts of the world, and at home in Canada too. So you know, we have our own issues here. It was just our entry point into the conversation from a very specific background, a very specific cultural identity, but like, it's the same thing that I think you see in other films, just specific to the lens of like Pakistan and this character's experience. Yeah,
it's a good thing we're in the U.S. where we have no issues.
Fortunate for us. Yeah, I want to hear, like, what were some of the biggest things that you learned from editing your first feature?
Yeah, I feel like there are a lot of things I learned on In Flames. There are a lot of things that were specific to that film because every film has its own challenge and it almost feels like you're learning the craft all over again. But In Flames was the biggest lesson for me as a first-time editor was, like, never... always be open-minded about what film you're making and how it's affecting people. And like, even from a level of tone and like genre, like what kind of film it is, because that changed throughout the edit. And it was pretty crazy. We, you know, I'm a big believer of outside feedback, test screening, sending to mentors for notes. And we've been working on this film, fine tuning it for months. And one of the last rounds of feedback, we sent it to everyone. And there was for the first time ever, we never heard this note before, but every single person said, you need a different ending. The ending you have doesn't work at all. Which is pretty wild because, it had never been a point of conversation or even an issue with anyone before, but it was just a sign that we'd been slowly molding this completely different film where somewhere along the line, the ending we originally had just didn't make any sense with this new film that we created. And that was just a reminder of like, you never really know what kind of film you have on your hands until, you know, you just have to blindly trust the process, follow instincts and listen to feedback and adapt when you need to. Because yeah, it's always changing. It's like our last tweak that we made was like cutting the ending. It's crazy.
Wow. So what did the film start out as genre wise, and what did you end up with?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's being marketed as a horror right now, but I think that's almost a disservice to the film because it's so much more than that in its current form. It's like a family drama. It's a psychological thriller. You know, and those aspects of the story, I think we leaned in a lot more on the later edits. I think the early, and even from a script point of view, I think the intention was like very classic horror. There were a lot of scares, a lot of horror scenes that we had to either minimize or cut out of the film, because it just, you know, it wasn't landing, or it just wasn't fitting of the story. Like once you film is like a constant conversation, you know, you make a script and then actors have their interpretation of it. And the cinematographer has their interpretation of it. The director changes it because of the weather of the day, you know, and then it reaches my hands. I'm like, this is different than what was in the script. So you need to adjust to that. And like, I think it was very classic horror. I think to generalize, we're finding that, you know, in horror, there's like the tension before a scare, and then the scare is like a release of tension. We were finding there are too many releases of tension from the horror scare parts of the view that were interfering with parts of the story that we need tension for dramatically. So, you know, there's a lot. I'm glad to hear that a lot of people are saying like they're on the edge of their seat watching this film, because I think it needed to be that from a very functional, like this character, there needs to be tension for us to care about her journey. And if there's a horror scare that kind of releases tension, whether you're conscious of it or not, you're caring less about what is actually more important to have tension for. So we're really from a very neutral standpoint, just tracking tension and making sure that that was effective. But it ended up losing a lot of the horror, and we ended up leaning into a more naturalistic, like art house film with these genre elements, but wasn't strictly one or the other.
That's really interesting to hear that like a jump scare is a release of tension, because it feels like those are like if you wanted to make like a scary movie, right, you just have like a ton of scary bits. But that's really interesting that like it's more unsettling to just have things and not have payoff.
Yeah, like
to have like a jump scare. Yeah.
Yeah, like the unsettling part is waiting for it to happen. Like if you get some sort of signal that something might be coming, that's almost the more, if you can do it right, like that should be the tension. And then all of a sudden it happens, and like that's scary, but also you're no longer waiting for something to happen, right? So yeah, it is by design sort of a release of tension.
Yeah, I recently watched Baby Reindeer, and I felt like that show left with no resolution of any kind, and it made me feel so upset.
I love that show.
Like,
yeah.
No, there's nothing that like pays off, you know? And so you like live with the tension the entire show. There's really never any point of, except for him like on stage, but there's no like release of tension, like you're saying. So that's very interesting. I've never thought of that though. Didn't know why.
Yeah, and unsettling. And our story, and that's clearly the design of that show, right? And I love that show. Our film, I think it was a clear intention to leave the audience with hope at the end of the film. So I think in order to reach that, you need to go through the ringer before you can be, you know, be like, okay, thank God that's over. We can be hopeful at the end of this.
When you were approaching this as your first feature, what was your process from getting it from that second cut, you know, your first cut to the end? Like, how do you even approach such a big project like that?
Yeah, it's not always, I mean, there becomes a point in any film, and I learned this from being an assistant editor and being fly on the wall, is that like there, you reach a point where you have no more objectivity. You know, like I was able to maintain it a little bit longer because I didn't edit the first draft. Zarrar did that. So I was able to have a very fresh reaction to the cut that he sent me. And I think it's a little bit easier to edit a film and receive a first cut and have instincts based on that. I think it's sometimes you lose your objectivity a little bit earlier when you start assembling the film. But I think I had very strong instincts based on a first watch that I wrote down, and you know, I kind of stayed true to them. And you know, sometimes I tackled them in a way that was making something else work. But in the end, like I think all those instincts ended up being the compass of what we wanted to do. And then you get to a point where you've watched this thing 100 times, you don't know if it's good or bad. And you rely on outside feedback. There's two kinds of feedback that are important to me. One is like a test screening that's in a space, and you're sitting at the back and you can actually feel the vibe of the room during certain moments, even if they're not filling out a questionnaire, which we do. You can feel sitting in a room with people, how they're reacting to the film. You can see the people on their phones when they're bored. You can see all that stuff. And, you know, you take meticulous notes about all of it. And even when I'm editing, like, you know, maybe I'm watching it back. I'll watch it back on my monitor. Maybe one day I'll watch it back on my phone. Maybe one day I'll watch it back downstairs on my theater system. You know, changing up where I'm sitting, what chair I'm in, just like anything, you can do like that. It actually, you'd be surprised how much it like refreshes your mind to the project. And I try and limit how much I'm watching it because I think some people obsessively watch over their scenes. That the only thing that that's doing is kind of killing your objectivity. The more you can remain fresh, like it's better to move on to something else and come back to that later than like just get hyper focused and fixated on something. So that's something I'm always tracking when I'm with the director. It's like, have we worked on this too long? Do we need to move on? Come back to it later. Usually that's almost always, that's the best thing to do. Oh, and the other type of feedback I mentioned is sending it to mentors, people you respect. Forgot to mention that. That's very crucial.
And were you sending full cuts? Were you sending sequences?
Full cuts. I felt it was good enough, because I mean, there's time, you shouldn't send something out if you feel like it's at a stage where like you already know what notes you're going to receive about it. Maybe the director needs to hear those notes, but like, I think you should always be in a place where like you're out of ideas. You can stand behind this 100%, because you don't want to be waste, you know, you only get one fresh watch with someone. You don't want to waste that on notes that you already know in your heart, you know?
Yeah, totally. When collaborating with a director on a feature, do you feel like it's helpful to go back and forth on sequences? Were you guys sending each other just like, you know, essentially shorter reels of content, or were you just always looking at the full cut of it in context? How do you approach really fine tuning something that's so big?
Yeah, I think at every step of the process, it's like, sometimes it takes longer, sometimes it takes shorter, but thinking of it as a pass with the director. So you watch it together in the same room, or, you know, you send the cutout and they watch it at home. And you have certain imprints from that watch, certain feelings and reactions. You write those down. And then you kind of work through those, not always linearly, but like, you know, you jump to whatever you have the energy for in that day. You just make sure to tackle everything. And then you watch the cut again. I think that's the best process for fine tuning a film. And eventually those passes get shorter and shorter and shorter, right? Like towards the end, you watch the film and you're like, oh, I only had a few small sound notes, you know, that you can do in a day or two and then watch it again. But even at that rough cut stage, I always think it's good to like have instincts, even if it's from weeks ago, of like watching a cut. So at that time, the next time you watch a full cut, it feels like, you know, you haven't watched in a long time. So you haven't seen all these changes. You kind of forgot about some of the ones you made. So you're a bit fresher when you have reactions to it.
Do you have a project that was a complete disaster and what you learned from the experience?
Definitely. I don't know if I'll say which ones were, but I've learned the same thing from any of those experiences, and it's, you know, like maybe I took a job because I needed money, or I was afraid that something better wouldn't come through, but in my heart I knew that like this wasn't for me, you know. I think that's a mistake that's very easy to make when you're starting. Like, you feel that pressure of like building a portfolio. You're like, oh, I haven't done a feature yet or something. And like, you feel like you need it for your resume. But I think, and anytime I've talked to an editor that I really respect their career and I want to have a career just like them, they've always had the same thing of like, you have to be really passionate about it from the get-go. You have to like only have the best predictions of how it's going to come out. Like, you have to love the script, you have to love the director you're working with and love their work, and see potential in that. Like, you need to see potential in the film. And I think anytime it didn't work out for me, I feel like it was my mistake for taking on something that wasn't a fit for me and then sort of dealing with that when it inevitably ended up not being for me, you know. So I think that's really important. It's a very privileged thing to say because we need work and stuff, but, and you know, as an assistant, I didn't care too much if my heart wasn't in a project, because it's such a technical administrative job. Like, I've worked on things that I didn't personally like as an assistant, but, like, you know, I like the people, we got along, we had fun. When you're an editor, it becomes so much more personal. It's like, you have to, in order to show up as a good editor, you have to, like, really care about the story. So that would be the one thing, yeah, that I learned.
There's a lot of editors out there that work on commercial work, or they're doing videos for nonprofits or more corporate side of things, non-narrative stuff. What advice would you give to them if they're wanting to make that jump to narrative stuff? I'm curious how you seem to have always been working on more narrative driven content and didn't really spend much time on more corporate side of, you know, turning this into a job where you have to make money. What advice would you give for those people wanting to break into the industry?
Well, I'll say I have done quite a bit of corporate stuff. I did, before I was an assistant editor, I couldn't find a job out of school, so I bought like a DSLR and I started a production company just myself, shooting, producing, editing, interviewing people if I needed to, coordinating, booking locations, all that stuff. And it worked out really well, and it was a good way for me to learn more about production. Yeah, my advice. And when I'm not finding work that is a good fit, I think it's good actually to have a connections to corporate and advertising stuff, because if you want to have an editing career that you can stand behind, I feel like you need to be okay with the economics point of it, where you just need to pay the bills and you're between projects and nothing that you're passionate about is coming to you. So it's almost better to lean in on the corporate stuff during periods like that and have access to that kind of work, I think it's really great. And a lot of my favorite editors, that's exactly what they do when they're not finding work, is they're doing corporate videos or advertising. So I think that's actually really good to have a foundation of those connections and be able to pull out that work whenever you need it. Because you need to survive off of money. But yeah, if you are wanting to focus more on more narrative stuff, I think I just got to a point with the corporate stuff where I was like, this isn't what I want to do. I really want to be here. So yeah, I think meeting as many people that you can who do the same thing. I'd have different advice for Canadians, because in Canada we have the Canadian Cinema Editors, and editors are in the union DGC. The Directors Guild, and there's a apprenticeship program for that. So there's a real avenue if you really want to get into like narratives editing. Like, you join the CCE, you go to Edicon, you apply for the apprenticeship program, and you meet, and just like, once you're in that, you have access to all the editors in Canada, reach out to them, have coffee, the ones that have careers that you're interested in. And I think there's similar things like that in the States, right? There's the ACE, which is like the CCE for us. And there's the unions that may or may not have apprenticeship programs. I don't know. But I think there's always a starting point like that. I think just surrounding yourself with people. And the great thing about Post is that I find people in Post are like very supportive. There's less competition for gigs and stuff. It's like, a lot of my gigs I've gotten from other editors who had to turn them down, and they just put my name up for it. And that's like incredibly generous. But I'm thankful that like we're in an industry that's kind of like that, at least in Canada. So even just meeting other editors, like they put me up for stuff.
On the flip side of that, what advice would you give to the producers and directors who are working with editors and VFX artists, people in Post, to better work and collaborate with them?
Yeah, I think the big thing is kind of, you know, we talked about feedback, and like, I think it's good to approach feedback from a perspective of like, here's how I felt watching it, you know, feelings and reactions as opposed to solutions and prescriptions. I think people people feel a pressure to like be useful in their notes, I think. Like, I don't think it's from a negative perspective. I think people actually want to be helpful, and they're racking their brains like, how can I give them a note that they can run with? But actually the opposite is the most helpful, is when you just say how you felt about it. And we can have, it's a starting point for a conversation where we find out together what the solution is. So that's always the best approach to approach any collaboration, whether it's editing or something else. And then in addition to that, I'd say like, I think there's not enough. I think like asking in post, a lot of people don't know about post and they assume that they can just do everything. I've received indie projects where they're like, they don't know what a online editor is, or what packaging is, or you know, what a conform is, or a dailies operator. There's all these or like even assistant editor, what an assistant editor does. There's all these aspects to post that people don't know about because they don't spend time in it. And I think if you're, the best thing you can do if you're a director or producer is just like learn as much about post as you can, because there's supports that we need that are crucial to us showing up properly and making, like doing the best with the time you've given us. And those things need to be built into the budget from the beginning. Like, you know, it's kind of absurd that you wouldn't have a camera department without like an assistant camera operator, at least one of them, you know, like, let alone three that's typical. It's like people really don't seem to not be aware of what the needs of post are, because we're not on set, we're not visible, we're like in at some computer somewhere. You're not seeing us on a daily basis, but we need support too. So I think that's good. Just educate yourself on post. And yeah,
totally. There's not just a button on our keyboard that says edit video.
Listen to this podcast.
Ooh, yeah. I like that. What has been like the best, you said you really like to, you have a lot of mentors, you really like to connect with a lot of mentors and people that pour into you. What is like the best piece of advice you've gotten when it comes to editing?
Ooh, like that. Well, that thing I shared earlier about tension and releasing tension was taught to me by Chris Donaldson, who edited Women Talking. That was something he was very perceptive of during the edit. And sometimes when the audience is bored or they're not caring about a character or a certain thing, it's like, it's something about that map of tension and release of tension that's throwing people off. So I think, yeah, there's a bunch of things. Like very early on, my biggest like brain exploding moment from a mentor was like, don't care about continuity. Continuity doesn't matter. And I was like, what? Like, I was so meticulous about like characters being in the right position and stuff. But, you know, like if people, just the idea that people are involved in the story and the motivations of the characters, they don't care about the continuity. And if they care about the continuity, there's bigger problems than the continuity. It's like, there's something in the story that isn't drawing them into the film.
That's so true. Anytime that I notice something off as, oh, that, you know, shirt was a little bit changed, or this bed was moved over that way or whatever, it's often because I'm not really paying attention to the story or the compelling nature of the characters.
Yeah, like the one thing, maybe continuity, is eye lines matter, because if you're absorbed in a story, you're looking at the character's eyes. But if you're looking at their shirt and like whether their shirt was, their buttons were open or closed, like that's, you're not paying attention to the film. You're looking somewhere else.
You were talking about the importance for producers to really supply post with the budget that's needed to do your job well, just like you would supply production with the people that they need to do the job well. I'm curious how you negotiate a rate on a project like In Flames. I'm sure with, you know, it being something you're really passionate about, there's always the leverage and ability you have to go lower on rates like that. But was it, I'm wondering more so from a high level perspective, was it just as simple as you charging like a day rate for this, or how did you work it out on this film?
Yeah. So the case of In Flames, very low budget production. And I feel like negotiation is always like a dance of like how much you need the project and how much they need you. And it's good to be aware of both of those things before you start negotiating. So for In Flames, you know, it was my first feature. I felt like I needed to work on it because I was like, this is exactly the type of film I want to work on. And I really love this director. We get along. I knew I was their first pick, but I don't think that was enough. And I was very aware that they were being completely transparent with me when they said we only have X amount of money. And I knew they had the best intentions with that. And I was like, you know, I just had to decide whether I was comfortable taking, like, on that case, it was a flat rate for the edit, which is often the case with indie low budget features, especially in Canada. Your first features you're working on are going to be on a flat rate. And when you divide it all by the days and the hours, it'll probably be minimum wage or less. You have to be okay with that. That's just kind of part of cutting your teeth on it. And, you know, I think, but there's things other than money that you can negotiate. You can say, okay, well, can we make the schedule longer? And are you flexible for me to take on like corporate work and stuff so that I can pay my bills while working on this project? So I think even if the money, there's no wiggle room on the money, there's always like some sort of consideration you can try and advocate for yourself to make it easier on you. And don't be shy about asking about those things, because especially if it doesn't cost them anything and if you think it's possible, like, yeah, absolutely. And I think it's worth bringing up those things because you don't want to be on a project and feel resentful and bitter because, like, you didn't, it's not enough money and you're not able to pay the bills. Like, you should know what your needs are at the beginning, ask for them and be flexible. You know, it's like, if you can't pay me more money, are you flexible with the hours so that I can actually make money while doing this? That's important. So yeah. And even, and on other projects, if they can't pay me enough, it's like, can I work from home, or can I, you know, can I have an assistant editor during production? Or, you know, maybe some of my weeks during production, you give that to an assistant editor and that saves you more money too. Not ideal, but, you know, if I would prefer that, I might as well ask for it. Right now I have an agent handling a lot of my negotiations, but one other thing I can say is time is on your side. So if you take a while to respond to something, it only makes them nervous. So don't feel like you need to have an answer right away. And if it's on a call, say like, maybe I need to think about this and get back to you. That only helps you. Because they're probably very anxious about like settling it as soon as possible, because productions have like time needs. They need to make these decisions soon. So, you know, it'll only help you in negotiation.
What are some of your favorite movies that you use for inspiration?
Ooh, that's tough. I feel like I like every type of movie. I know that's a cop-out answer. Usually with every film I get, I could sort of build out a playlist of music that reminds me of the script. And I also sort of think of movies that are inspiration for me. I think Holy Motors is a huge all-time favorite for me. From an editing point of view, I think that's a film that like has no plot whatsoever, like very, very little plot. But it's like, I still had that experience the first time I watched it of like being on the edge of my seat, like I would be in like a thriller or something like that. I don't know what it was, but something about the way it was made, it was like, I can't wait to see what happens next, even though it's all really absurd and it doesn't mean anything. I don't know, all-time favorite. I seem to like movies with like really gripping like stakes and tension. Do the Right Thing is an all-time favorite. Just because of the, like that feeling you have throughout the entire film, tension sort of reaching a boiling up point, and even how they color graded that film to be like to make you feel like you're sweating while you're watching it. It's like, it feels like a hot summer day. I don't know. Yeah. Oh man. I try and watch a movie every day. So there's a lot that I really love.
Any good ones of?
That's impressive. Yeah, that's a lot.
That
of
is
movies.
A ton of movies. Any good ones?
I'm doing the Criterion Challenge right now.
You have time for that with a child? That's crazy.
Yeah, just hold the. I mean, now I'm starting to think, like, should I be watching certain movies while I'm holding my baby? But he's very young, so.
but that'll. Memories.
I watched The Shining when I was like 6 years old, and that's burned into my memory. Also, another all-time favorite. Nice. Yeah.
Any good ones as
what
of?
What about you two? Any?
I just went and saw Furiosa. That was really good.
Cool.
I'm kind of lame. I have like the classic, I feel like VFX response, but I love Into the Spider-Verse, Across the Spider-Verse.
Oh, so good.
I love Dune. Dune 1 and 2. Some of my faves.
I haven't gotten into the Dune movies yet, but I feel like I need to before the next one comes out so I can see it in theaters.
Yeah, they're so good. I love Star Wars, but I hate the Star Wars movies, like any good Star Wars fan. Only TV shows. Damn. Sci-fi that awesome. Looks good.
Did you watch Civil War? I haven't seen that yet, but I'm excited to.
Yes. Yeah, that's definitely worth watching. It was really...
Is that sci-fi? Maybe it's not. I don't know.
Yeah, I feel like it's more like a thriller. Really good. Super haunting. Definitely worth
it. Alex Garland has some great sci-fi, like the... I really liked Annihilation and Ex Machina. Yeah,
yep. Okay, well, final question. I'm kind of curious how listeners can keep up with you, your work, future endeavors, and where we can follow along.
I'm mostly on Instagram, Craig's Benny, CraigsBenny. I'm also on X, but I don't really post much on there. So that's probably where to find me.
Nice. Anything exciting coming up that you're working on that you can talk about?
I don't know if, yeah, I worked on a, because sometimes I'm not allowed to talk about the specifics of a project. I have two features that should be coming out soon, and I have a documentary with Prime that should be coming out maybe next year. I can't, unfortunately, get into the specifics of what they're about or what their names are, but I'm excited for that. If you follow me, I will definitely annoy you with details on those when they come out.
Awesome. Or we'll just have to go watch every documentary and feature film ever and just look for your name.
Yeah. Yeah, that's another way too.
Cool. Well, thanks for coming on, Craig.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It's been fun chatting with you too.